Imagine trying to buy a house, right? But the blueprints change literally every time you look at them.
Oh, that sounds like a complete nightmare.
Right. And the foundation needs to be custom poured daily. Plus, the real estate agent is speaking a language you have, never even heard before.
Yeah, you'd probably just give up.
Exactly. But that is exactly what it feels like to try and find the right educational environment for a neurodivergent child. Usually looking for a school is just it's a standard checklist exercise for a family, right?
You check the commute, look at the district's test scores.
Yeah, maybe glance at the extracurriculars and you just make it work.
Yeah.
It is essentially like buying clothes off the rack. But when you step into the world of special education, you are definitely not buying off the rack anymore.
No, absolutely not. You need bespoke tailoring at that point.
Exactly. And whether you are a parent currently navigating this completely overwhelming maze, or maybe an educator looking to understand different classroom dynamics, or just an insanely curious learner understanding how we educate entirely unique minds is just an absolute masterclass in human development.
It really is. And the stakes, I mean, they are incredibly high. We are not just talking about creating a space where a student can, pass a standardized math test.
Right, the goals are way bigger.
Exactly. We're talking about engineering an environment where a child can safely exist, where they can process sensory information without panic, and actually learn to thrive on their own terms.
Which is huge. So today, our deep dive is tackling a recently updated, just incredibly comprehensive resource. It was published on March 12, 2026 by AngelSense.
Yes, it's fantastic, guy.
It really is. And it breaks down the best autism schools in California. Our mission today is to decode this massive menu of options, figure out what mechanically makes a classroom autism-friendly, and uncover the hidden metrics of a successful specialized education.
There is a lot to get through.
There is. Okay, let's unpack this, starting with just the sheer scale of the landscape in California. Because the numbers here really set the stage for everything else. California currently has an autism prevalence rate of about 4.5%.
Wow.
Yeah. And for context, the national average in the US sits at 3.2%.
What's fascinating here is the sheer volume of unique needs that 4.5% represents.
Yeah.
I mean, that could be the result of more aggressive diagnostic techniques in the state, or maybe increased cultural awareness leading to more evaluations.
Or just simply the massive density of California's population.
Exactly. But regardless of the underlying mechanism, the state has been forced by necessity to develop a highly robust, intensely diverse ecosystem of school models to support this population. You
Right.
cannot just have like one type of special education classroom and expect it to serve a group that large and that diverse.
No, which makes total sense. Looking at the different frameworks available, it honestly reminds me of picking the right vehicle for a cross-country road trip.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, like you wouldn't take a low-clearance sports car off-roading, and you certainly wouldn't take a massive heavy-duty RV onto a tight, winding city street.
Right, you'd get stuck immediately.
Exactly. Each school model is built for a totally different developmental terrain. To an outsider, the system just looks like this intimidating alphabet soup of acronyms. But if we break down the four primary vehicles, the landscape becomes much easier for you to navigate.
Let's look at those four frameworks. First, you have private autism-specific schools. These are your heavy-duty, highly customized vehicles.
The ones built for the toughest terrain.
Precisely. They offer incredible levels of support, often boasting one-to-one teacher-student ratios. They cater to profound needs, but the trade-off for that level of customization is, of course, the financial cost.
Right, they can be very expensive.
Very. Second, there are therapeutic day schools. These are also privately operated, but they hold unique state certifications to meet specific California standards. They are engineered for autistic children who require intense, continuous daily care and behavioral intervention.
And then I noticed a third option in the guide that sort of bridges the gap between private and public, which are inclusive charter schools.
Yes, those are super interesting.
They really are. They are publicly funded, which makes them an accessible, free alternative for families, but they operate with a dedicated structural focus on special needs. It operates almost like a hybrid vehicle, right? You get the specialized, targeted features of a private school, but it runs on the accessible infrastructure of the public system.
That is a great way to put it. And finally, there are public special education programs housed entirely within traditional mainstream public schools.
Okay, so who are those best for?
These programs are generally best suited for children with high levels of social and academic ability. We are talking about students who can handle advanced academic subjects and who genuinely benefit from the social interaction of a mainstream campus, but who just require specific, targeted supports to manage their day.
Got it. So instead of just reading down a list of schools geographically, let's actually look at how these different models operate on the ground. Let's examine their core educational philosophies. Because success looks completely different depending on the building you walk into.
It really does. Night and day.
Yeah. Let's start with a philosophy that might actually surprise people. The ultimate goal of transitioning a child out of specialized care entirely.
Which sounds counterintuitive, but it's brilliant.
Right. There is a school in San Jose called Pine Hill Second Start. And here's where it gets really interesting. They use a dual track system for their 87 students.
Yes, I was looking at that.
They maintain a 7-to-1 ratio, but they physically and philosophically divide the school into two completely different programs, the Edison program and the Newton program.
Right. And the Edison program focuses heavily on children requiring more emotional and behavioral therapies. But the Newton program is what really illustrates this transition philosophy. It is academically oriented, specifically for students with level 1 or level 2 autism.
Let's pause there for a second and define those terms for someone who might not be familiar with the diagnostic language. What functionally is the difference between level 1 and level 2 in a classroom setting?
Good question. It really comes down to the amount of external support required for daily functioning. A student with level 1 autism might struggle with nuanced social cues, reading the room, or organizing their executive functions to complete a multi-step project.
But they can generally hold their own?
Mostly, yeah. They can generally communicate effectively and follow a curriculum with some basic accommodations. A student with level 2 autism, however, requires substantial support.
Okay, what does that look like?
They might face more pronounced communication challenges, rely heavily on rigid routines to feel safe, and experience intense distress if that routine changes suddenly.
Makes sense. And for those specific profiles in the Newton program, the incredible objective, the reason the school is quite literally called Second Start, is that the ultimate goal is not to keep the kids enrolled.
No, not at all.
Their whole mission is to prepare these students to successfully return to mainstream, regular public classrooms. They are actively utilizing specialized techniques to graduate kids out of their own ecosystem.
It is a phenomenal objective. We see a similar philosophy of building broader community integration at the East Valley Education Center in Oakdale, too.
Oh, right, up in Northern California.
Yeah. It is a private school covering grades 6 through 12. They maintain a 13-to-1 ratio, which is actually close to the national average for standard classrooms, and they have a small overall footprint of about 60 students.
So what makes them stand out?
What is crucial here is that they are accredited to provide actual high school diplomas. Their curriculum goes way beyond just passing tests. They focus heavily on job placement, community wellness, global awareness, and social responsibility. They are using their customized environment to build independent citizens.
That's awesome. But what happens when a child's profile is so complex that transitioning out into a mainstream public school or pursuing a standard high school diploma simply is not the goal?
That's when you have to pivot.
Right. We have seen how certain programs focus on mainstream integration, but that brings us to the highly intensive, specialized models. And to look at those, we generally pivot to the programs highlighted in Southern California in the guide.
Yes, the guide has a great section on those.
Although I have to point out a highly amusing geographic glitch in our source material. It lists Beacon Bay School as being located in San Jose, which is very much Northern California, but categorizes the school strictly under its Southern California section.
I noticed that too.
We will just affectionately blame a sleepy copy editor for that one and focus on the school's actual mechanics because their approach is fascinating.
Exactly. Regardless of what side of the fault line they are on, Beacon Day School serves about 100 students from kindergarten through 12th grade, maintaining a 10-to-1 ratio. A large majority of their student body are people of color, actually.
Oh, that's interesting. What's their specific focus?
What makes their philosophy stand out is a dedicated focus on older students. They deploy programs that combine behavioral and instructional therapy to specifically help older individuals transition into the workforce and learn the mechanics of living independently.
Now, compare that 10-to-1 ratio at Beacon to the Elliott Institute in La Crescenta. This feels like a completely different universe in terms of intensity.
Oh, absolutely.
It is a K-12 and adult transition program, but they only have 26 students in the entire school, and the teacher-student ratio is a staggering 2-to-1.
That ratio tells you everything you need to know about the level of complex support required there. Students at the Elliott Institute do not receive a high school diploma.
Right, that's not the goal there at all.
No. The strict, unwavering focus is on intense language and behavior intervention. They utilize highly specific methodologies, primarily ABA and TCC therapies. Furthermore, they are equipped to support complex co-occurring conditions. They aren't just supporting autism.
What else are they treating?
They are actively teaching children with ADHD, epilepsy, and cerebral palsy.
I want to push back on that 2-to-1 ratio for a second, though. If you are a parent listening to this, placing your child in an environment where there is essentially one teacher for every two students sounds incredibly isolating.
I can see how it sounds that way.
Right. Doesn't heavily isolating a child in a 2-to-1 ratio completely remove their ability to learn vital social skills with their peers?
That is a very common, very understandable concern. But it goes back to the concept of foundational needs. You cannot focus on peer socialization if a child is experiencing constant, overwhelming sensory distress or engaging in severe self-injurious behavior.
Okay. That makes sense, yeah.
A 2-to-1 ratio is not about isolating the child. It is about providing a hyper-secure foundation. Once the environment is predictable and the child feels entirely safe, then you can slowly introduce peer interactions.
Okay, so safety first, socialization second.
Exactly. And that is where therapies like TCH come into play. TDEH is a method that physically structures the classroom environment. Instead of relying on a teacher to constantly give verbal instructions, which can be overwhelming, to process a TCH classroom uses clear visual boundaries.
Like what? What does that look like?
There might be colored tape on the floor defining a specific workspace, or highly visual step-by-step schedules on the wall. The physical environment itself tells the child exactly what is expected of them, drastically reducing their daily anxiety.
That makes a lot of sense. The environment does the heavy lifting so the child's brain doesn't have to. We also see intensive behavioral shifts being the primary goal at the Kendall Centers.
Yes, the Blue Sprig Network.
Right. This is a network of six therapeutic day schools. They lean heavily into applied behavioral analysis, or ABA, for children of all ages. Mechanically, ABA involves breaking down complex skills like washing hands or asking for a break into incredibly small, manageable steps and using positive reinforcement to encourage those steps.
And the Kendall Centers offer immense flexibility with this therapy. Families can utilize day school, at-home treatment, or even virtual treatment.
I have to ask you to translate a massive data point related to those centers, though. The organization claims that treatment at their facilities delivers an average 90% reduction in severe behaviors.
It's an incredible number.
It is a staggering statistic, but what does a 90% drop in severe behavior actually mean for the psychological reaction of a family on a random Tuesday morning?
It represents a profound shift in a family's entire existence. When a household is dealing with high-frequency severe behaviors, we are talking about intense, prolonged meltdowns, severe self-injury, or physical property destruction. That family is living in a permanent state of crisis management.
Just constantly on edge.
Every single day. From the moment they wake up, it is simply about surviving until bedtime without a catastrophe. A 90% reduction means you are finally removing the crisis. Yeah. When you remove that constant state of hypervigilance, that massive amount of physical and emotional energy can be redirected into actual skill building. The child can finally focus on learning to communicate their needs, and the parents can actually breathe.
It's life-changing.
It is the fundamental difference between desperately treading water to keep from drowning and finally being able to learn how to swim.
That paints an incredibly vivid picture. Speaking of learning to communicate needs, another facility, the Speech and Language Development Center, also known as Linden Oaks in Wayna Park, focuses heavily on communication for complex profiles.
Yes, communication is a huge hurdle for many.
Right. It is a nonprofit serving everyone from preschoolers up to age 22. Alongside ABA and mental health therapy, their primary tool is the application of AAC.
AAC stands for Augmentative and Alternative Communication. It encompasses all the different ways a person can communicate besides talking.
So not just speech.
Right. For a non-speaking autistic child, AAC is the key to unlocking their internal world. It ranges from low-tech options, like pointing to a physical board with pictures of food or emotions, to high-tech speech-generating devices.
Like tablets.
Exactly. often a specialized tablet where a child taps a series of icons and the tablet verbalizes the sentence for them. Imagine the sheer frustration of being thirsty and completely unable to tell anyone. AAC removes that barrier.
The variance across all these models is just wild. We also have charter networks like Opportunities for Learning or OFL, which offers free specialized support for ages 14 and up who simply didn't fit into a traditional high school environment.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, that immense variance is exactly the point. When you compare a school with a 13-to-1 ratio whose primary goal is handing out high school diplomas to a school with a 2-to-1 ratio whose primary goal is establishing basic behavioral safety without any diplomas, it proves that the concept of the absolute best school is a total myth.
Because it's so subjective.
Exactly. Best means completely different things depending entirely on the neurological profile of the specific child.
So what does this all mean? If ratios, geographic locations, and the public versus private debate are just the surface level details, what actually makes a classroom mechanically autism friendly?
It's a great question.
It brings me back to the idea of buying a house. You cannot just look at the square footage, or in this case, the class size. The square footage doesn't matter if the foundation is crumbling or if the neighborhood is entirely wrong for your family. What is the foundation of an autism-friendly space?
Class size is a common metric parents latch onto, but it is just the starting line. True autism friendliness is found in 5 core operational factors. First, dedicated individual instruction.
Meaning what exactly?
Right.
Even in a small class, the critical question is whether the student is receiving personalized engagement tailored to their specific processing speed. Second, highly trained, verifiable staff. You can often check the specific certifications of the educators and therapists right on the school's website, ensuring they are trained in the exact methodologies your child needs.
Whether that is TCCH, ABA, or AAC implementation, transparency is huge there.
Absolutely. Third, the environment must utilize structured routines. For many neurodivergent minds, predictability equals safety. If the rules or the schedule change arbitrarily, the brain perceives it as a threat.
That sounds exhausting.
It is. Specialized schools prioritize rigorous structure to minimize daily anxiety. Fourth, integrated on-site therapies. When speech therapy or occupational therapy happens physically at the school, it ensures consistency. The therapist and the teacher can collaborate in real time.
Plus, I'd imagine it provides massive convenience for caretakers who are no longer forced to shuttle their child to 3 different clinics across town after the school bell rings.
Oh, the convenience is a game changer for parents. And the fifth factor is deep parental involvement. There must be strong, continuous homeschool communication so parents can bridge the gap and reinforce what is happening in the classroom when the child comes home.
That makes total sense.
Beyond those 5 operational factors, you have to consider the physical environment itself. A truly autism-friendly space is architecturally designed to reduce sensory overload.
Like the lighting and sounds.
Exactly. That means installing specialized lighting that doesn't flicker or hum, utilizing acoustic dampening materials to eliminate harsh echoes, and actively providing designated quiet spaces or sensory rooms where a child can go to self-regulate before a meltdown occurs.
All of those foundational elements are crucial. But when it actually comes time for a family to make their choice, there is a fascinating framework suggested for making the decision. You have to reverse engineer the child's future.
Yes. Start with the end in mind.
Right. You have to start by looking 10, 20 years down the road and choosing between 3 primary long-term goals: vocational readiness, inclusion, or independence.
Exactly. Let's look at what those actually mean for a family's daily life. If a family's primary goal is vocational readiness, they are looking for a school whose ultimate objective is getting that individual into the workforce in a job they genuinely enjoy, where their specific skills are respected and utilized.
Okay, what about inclusion?
If the goal is inclusion, the priority shifts heavily toward building an active social life. The daily curriculum focuses on forming and maintaining healthy friendships, navigating community spaces, and participating in group activities.
And if the priority is independence, the long-term goal is the individual living on their own or with minimal assistance.
Right.
The daily focus is on life skills, managing a personal budget, cooking meals safely, maintaining a clean home, and navigating public transportation. Once a parent defines which of those 3 visions is the ultimate priority, picking the school becomes much clearer because you are simply matching the school's philosophy to that specific desired outcome.
But we have to acknowledge a massive caveat here. All the vocational training, AC devices and social inclusion goals in the world are entirely moot if the absolute foundational layer of physical safety isn't secured first.
Right.
A child cannot learn if they are not physically safe.
And the terrifying reality for many caretakers of autistic individuals is the profound risk of elopement or wandering off. We are not talking about kids trying to casually play hooky.
No, it's not rebellion.
Right. The triggers for a neurodivergent child leaving a safe space are intense. It can be triggered by a sudden sensory meltdown, overwhelming anxiety, or a bullying incident. It frequently happens during momentary security lapses at recess or lunch, or when a child has difficulty transitioning between two different activities and simply tries to escape the demand.
It is a constant underlying terror for caregivers. And this is where we see a fascinating intersection of education and specialized technology. Our source material highlights a specific tech solution called AngelSense, which utilizes AI in a highly proactive way to address the vulnerability of elopement.
I found the mechanics of this fascinating. It is not just a passive GPS dot on a map. Think of it like a highly intelligent digital geofence or a smart thermostat that learns a family's specific rhythm.
How so?
Well, the AI actually learns a child's normal, everyday locations and transit routes. If the child unexpectedly exits those normal boundaries, the system doesn't wait for the parent to check an app. It pushes proactive, automatic alerts to the caregivers immediately.
It also includes an SOS call button and a two-way communication feature, meaning a parent can instantly open a line and speak directly to the child if they are lost or panicked.
That is incredible.
And in a worst-case scenario, it provides real-time tracking that caregivers can share instantly with school officials and first responders to coordinate a rescue.
This raises an important question, though, about the delicate balance between protection and autonomy. We just spent all this time talking about the beautiful goals of independence and community inclusion. As a child grows, they inherently need to explore the world to achieve those goals. Does strapping a GPS tracker to them inhibit that independence?
It is a vital ethical and practical question. The crucial distinction here is that this kind of assistive technology aims to provide caregivers with profound peace of mind without ever replacing the actual educational or therapeutic strategies of the school.
So it's supplemental.
Exactly. The technology is the safety net. The school's curriculum is the launch pad. The tech ensures the child survives long enough to actually experience the benefits of the education. When a parent knows their child cannot wander off into traffic unnoticed, they're far more willing to let that child go on a community field trip to practice their inclusion skills.
The safety net allows for the risk required to grow. So bringing all of this together, the core thesis we have uncovered today is incredibly clear. Finding the best special education environment is never about looking up national rankings, obsessing over standard class sizes, or finding the most prestigious private name.
Not at all.
It is about a highly intricate, deeply personal matchmaking process. It is about aligning a child's totally unique communication style, their specific sensory thresholds, and their long-term life aspirations with the exact operational philosophy of a school.
You are matching the specific blueprint of the child to the specific foundation of the environment.
And honestly, even if you are not currently in the position of placing a child in a special education program, observing how these specialized environments adapt to, support, and ultimately unlock human potential is incredibly inspiring. It challenges how we view standard education as a whole.
It really does. And it leaves me with a final thought for us to mull over. We are watching specialized schools achieve incredible life-changing results for complex individuals by doing things like tailoring the sensory environment to reduce ambient stress, utilizing highly predictable routines to boost productivity, and integrating technology that specifically accommodates a person's unique vulnerabilities.
They are literally redesigning the physical and structural environment to fit the human, instead of forcing the human to painfully contort themselves to fit a rigid environment.
Exactly. So the provocative question is, how long will it be until traditional mainstream adult workplaces are forced to adopt these exact same neuroinclusive principles?
Oh, wow.
Right? The generation currently growing up in these highly supportive, intensely customized environments is eventually going to enter the broader workforce.
Yeah.
And they are going to arrive expecting the world to accommodate their unique minds, not the other way around.
They won't settle for less.
Exactly. If a corporation wants to attract and retain the brilliant, unique talent that thinks outside the box, they're going to have to realize that the box itself needs to be redesigned.
That is a fascinating shift to think about. We started by discussing how finding a school for a neurodivergent mind feels like navigating a maze blindfolded, searching for a blueprint that keeps shifting. But maybe these specialized schools are not just drawing blueprints for their own students. Maybe, just maybe, they are quietly drafting the master blueprint for how all of us will work, learn, and thrive in the future.